Hi, this is Jan Pritzker.
And this is Gary Leland, and you're listening to episode 140 of the Crypto Cousins Podcast.
Feed your interest in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies by joining Hall of Fame podcaster Gary Leland on the Crypto Cousins Podcast. And remember, we are all cousins in the world of crypto. This week's price of Bitcoin.
$9,477. That's up $682, or 7.7% over the past 7 days. Howdy, 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 Jan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here, Gary. Real excited.
Yeah, I just finished your book recently, and I know you sent me copies like a year ago. it took me a long time to get to it, but I got to it, and I went right through it. That's a great book. In case y'all aren't familiar, Jan wrote the book Inventing Bitcoin, and we got a lot to talk about that. Before we get into that, though, tell us a little bit about your background, a short bio, if you would.
Yeah, my bio is kind of complicated. I don't know if I can keep it short, but I'll try. I've been a technology person and a startup person for the last 20 years. I've been doing a lot of startups. But I'm also a former immigrant from the former Soviet Union. So I came over to the United States in 1989. I was just 7 years old. I came with my parents and my sister. And grew up doing, you know, computer stuff, and eventually ended up doing startups. And went through about 6 different startups over the last 20 years. The last one was called Reverb. Reverb was co-founded in 2012 along with David Kalt, who was the founder. And him and I built out Reverb to be the best place for musicians to buy and sell gear. And pretty much over the next, you know, 6 years, we went from just the two of us to about 150 employees, doing about $500 million in sales. And it just became this huge thing. And meantime, as I was, you know, doing the Reverb thing as kind of my full-time gig, I was getting really interested in Bitcoin. Kind of fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole in 2016, and spent a couple of years just, you know, podcasts, books, YouTubes. And by 2018, I just felt like that was the most important thing I could work on. So I ended up leaving Reverb in 2018 in order to be a part of the Bitcoin space, not really knowing what I was going to do. But that's kind of how I started my journey.
So you got in 16. So you got in at a really good price, I guess, at the time.
Well, technically I got in 2011, except for in 2011, I bought Bitcoin at the top, which was $30. And I sold
the bottom. Oh my God, you got ripped off.
I know. And then, you know what else happened afterwards? I sold the bottom at $2. So I did the classic, move of buying the top and selling the bottom. I didn't know the first thing about trading. I wasn't even trading stocks at that point. I think I had I had some Apple shares or something. But pretty much bought the top, sold the bottom, didn't know what I got into. And 2013, same thing happened to me because it was in the media again. And again, I remembered Bitcoin was interesting. I didn't know what it was. So I'm very embarrassed about this because, you know, being a technology person, I should have at least researched it and understood it and read the white paper. I did none of those things. I didn't even know there was a white paper. I literally just heard there were some people building a payment system. I thought it was a payment system, which it turned out not to be. And then I bought some just in case, but it turned out that I didn't invest my time until really 2016 came around.
Hopefully in 2016, you held on to it this time.
I did. It was the first time I actually stuck because I had more conviction around what it was after having understood it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, you said you immigrated from Russia, but you were very young when your family mm-hmm. moved here from Russia. Do you remember anything about the motherland? Or?
Yeah, I was 7, and I remember a little bit. I remember, you know, I was a kid, so I remember my childhood, as most kids do, pretty fondly. I didn't have any real issues, other than maybe some bullying, anti-Semitism, which is, you know, common in Russia. But, you know, my childhood was normal, and it wasn't really until we got to America and experienced what it looks like in a capitalist country with like actual abundance and grocery stores and stuff like that, that we finally understood like what we had been, like basically that we had been lied to around, you know, what life is supposed to be like. Because in Russia, you know, in Soviet Union, you hear about it, there was food shortages, there was bread lines, there was shortages of basic goods, and obviously like nobody made any money. And the only, you know, what was interesting about that experience after I got into Bitcoin is I finally understood what the purpose of Bitcoin was after I talked to my parents about our experience, because it turns out that when we left the Soviet Union, we weren't able to keep our money because there were capital controls. So you couldn't own US dollars. And the government allowed us to take $100 per person. And that's what they exchanged for us, you know, from Soviet rubles to dollars. So we left the country with $400 in our pocket.
So on the leaving with the $400, is that because, well, I know it's because it was the law, but is that because you had to, you can't exchange rubles anywhere else and you couldn't sneak them out?
Right. So you could exchange them on the street, but the street exchange rate was different from the government exchange rate. Similar to what you might hear about in Venezuela or Argentina or other countries that have capital controls, usually the government has this official exchange rate, right? So it might be like 10 to 1, but on the street, it might be 100 to 1. So that means our rubles are basically worthless. Like nobody actually wanted them. You know, why would you exchange rubles, which were basically a garbage currency, for the US dollar, which is something that everybody wanted, right? The US dollar was in high demand in Russia, even though it was actually illegal to own. So people used it for bribes. People used it to store value because that was the only currency they could get their hands on that held any value. So nobody wanted the Soviet currency because it was completely government controlled. So there was, you know, obviously the price of it is not real.
if no one wants the currency, which, you know, I realize no one wants, I'm not doubting that. I'm not arguing that point. Why do they care if you take it?
No, they don't care. I mean, I'm just saying they wouldn't. It's not that they were trying to take it. It's that we wanted dollars.
No, I meant the government.
Yeah, no, the government. We wanted dollars to leave the country, right? We wanted to go to America with dollars.
So you could take all the rubles with you wanted.
Yeah, but they would. Well, I don't.
You just were only going to be able to cash them in at, like, in Russia.
For nothing. Yeah. Basically, they were useless, you know, worthless. So I don't know if it's true if we could take the rubles with us or not. I'm not sure what the actual policy on that was. But I do know that U.S. dollar ownership was illegal other than, you know, through official channels.
Right. When you first got here, or your parents, I guess you've talked to them about this. Now that you're kind of into money, you know, once you get into Bitcoin, you start exploring money and what money is and mm-hmm. the history of money. There's a lot of information about money that we just don't know.
Yep.
Because we just spend it and don't know what it is or what it's backed by or anything like that. So I assume once you started getting into Bitcoin and money, you started asking them a lot of questions about what it was like under a socialist economy. And they've told you stories about their lives there. Yeah, I see now a big move in the United States towards, by young people, towards socialism. Mm-hmm. Being an old guy, 65 years old, you know, I was always taught that socialism, communism was the worst thing that could happen to the world, you know, as a kid. I mean, we were just told that over and over and over. And so I still probably have a lot of that in my thought patterns when I think about things. But I'm curious, how did your parents, someone who fled socialism, who knew exactly what it was, and then came and have lived here for a long time, probably lived here for a long time before you talked to them about money.
Oh, yeah.
what were their thoughts on socialism versus or communism or whatever versus a free market?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, when you leave an environment like the Soviet Union, where there's basically shortages and scarcity of goods, and it's not like there was scarcity of resources, it was all because they were badly allocated. You know, people were doing things because the prices were fixed, that they didn't know if they were to produce more of something or less of something. So it was not a good situation. And when we got to America, it was very abundant. You know, a lot of Russian immigrants will tell you that their first memory of America is like walking into a grocery store and seeing, you know, 20 varieties of bread. Like, that's an unimaginable idea in a socialist economy. So you see that kind of variety and abundance, and you know, you're pretty much instantly sold. So, you know, obviously my parents have a pretty strong aversion to the idea of socialism, communism.
Are they still alive?
Yeah, they're alive and well. And they're very active for their age. My dad actually climbed Mount Everest just 10 years ago. He was 53 at the time. So
your dad's like my age. I'm 65. Your dad's like my age.
He's, okay. He's your age. Yeah, exactly. And my mom's just a few years younger. But, you know, they obviously, I think a lot of Russian immigrants will tell you, like, they don't like where this country's headed. They're very concerned about the socialist tendencies that are arising. You know, I kind of, my circle of friends is pretty liberal, I would say. So in my circle of friends, you know, there's always certain like well-meaning things that people want, you know, like we should take care of our fellow man and all that kind of stuff. There's a line that gets crossed when you go from let's take care of our fellow man to like, let's have the government use guns to force us to take care of our fellow man, which is a difficult it's a difficult thing to understand that that's where this goes eventually. And it doesn't always have to go there, right? There are countries out there that have some socialist policies. I mean, America has tons of socialist policies.
Yeah.
Social Security, I mean,
Medicare,
lots of it. Medicare, right?
I like Medicare. Don't get me wrong. That's like a hell of a deal.
And of course, there's a certain element to, you know, public education, all these kinds of things. You know, my wife works in public education. We live in a great neighborhood with a very good public school. Some public schools aren't very good. But ours is great. So the question is like, you know, there's always socialist policies. There's also socialism on the corporate level, as we know, with the Fed allowing corporations to get very cheap loans, that we probably call that corporate socialism and causing a lot of wealth inequality here. There's no perfect system, but there's definitely a place where, you know, I think if my parents, if you ask them about this, they would much prefer a system of free market and freedom in general, because when markets aren't free, then really nothing is free. The flow of information has to also not be free. The flow of currency is stopped. Everything is locked down, because once, if you live in socialist Russia, you either live in that socialist bubble and you think everything's okay, or you see the outside world and all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait, this is not right. Like, you know, there's no breadlines in America. Why are there breadlines here?
Yeah, they can't expose you to the real information out there or you'll get pissed off.
Exactly. So Russia was heavily censored. You know, all information was heavily censored. There was only state TV. There was like three channels, and letters, you know, were presumed to be read going out to America. You know, we had to like, it was a bad situation. And I don't think anybody wants to live in that kind of world who's seen the other side.
You know, I don't think anybody would want to live in that world at all, whether they've seen the other side or not. So that's interesting. I was curious what your parents' thoughts would be on, you know, especially since they're my age, on seeing how many people are wanting socialism nowadays. It just surprises me the amount of people I see that are in favor of that. Like I said, because I've just always been, I don't know, to me, it always just made sense that if you work hard, you can be rich. If you don't want to work, you're not going to be rich.
I don't think it's as black and white as that. There's also elements of like, you know, luck of the draw. Where are you born? What's your community like?
Yeah,
and there's a lot of other stuff that goes into it.
But I think you can work past that if you work. Now, you know, like I may not be the president of the United States rich, but
yeah.
I grew up on an island, for an example, as a white dude. So I was,
yeah.
I did get a break there.
Right.
I will admit that's a break.
There are systemic things that happen. I mean, if you grow up in a neighborhood where there's just like you're fighting for your life to survive, I mean, that's a systemic thing. Your bar to get out of that area is way higher than, you know, somebody who was born even in poverty as a white dude or whatever. I don't want to get into that necessarily.
No, I admit I got a hell of a right being a white dude compared to a lot of people. There's no doubt about that. I used to, when I first heard that statement, white privilege, I was like, what the hell is that?
But right.
Now I've come to understand that is a true thing. And you're right. If I grew up in a neighborhood where someone was being shot every week and I was just trying to stay alive and my whole goal was just to get to stay alive rather than going, hey, no one's trying to kill me.
And if your only way of making money, like enough money, is to sell drugs, and that was the only, and then on top of that, you were threatened with violence if you didn't. I mean,
right. You know, that's a big difference. You're correct.
It's a much different bar to get over than.
Where I'm going down to the golf course, which we weren't rich enough to be a member, but I could go to the 18th hole and sell Cokes to those golfers for 50 cents each or something.
I mean, we came to this country with nothing. And a lot of times people are like, well, look, I came to this country with nothing and I built this life. But my dad was an engineer. My mom was a teacher. They had education, like world-class education. I mean, say what you will about the Soviet Union, but the education system was very good. And they produced some of the best engineers. And we came to this country with all that and all this culture and background. And of course, we were able to build it back up. You know, it took a long time, but we were able to do it. It's not equal for everybody in that sense.
No, I agree with you completely. You made a good point there.
But again, it's like, what do you do, right? I mean, you want to try to help other people. You can do that voluntarily, or you can say, okay, well, we're going to like ask the government to, you know, take everybody, half of everybody's paycheck and pay for these other people. And for me, like, I would happily do that for my local community. Not so sure I should be paying for somebody that lives halfway across the world, or to fight wars or other things, which is, you know, where federal taxes end up going.
But, and then you have to go, you know, if they're able to print as much money as they want, why don't we just get out of everything and just print money and take care of everybody here? Yeah, I agree with you on all that. So where did y'all move when you moved here?
We ended up in a suburb of Chicago, because in order to move to the United States at the time, you basically had to have somebody here that would essentially vouch for you and say they'd take care of you. Like they would request your immigration and say they would be your caretaker and all that. So we had like my grandpa's, you know, cousin that was living here. So we were able to use him to fish us out of there.
Right.
And yeah, so I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago and went to school downstate in Illinois at the Urbana-Champaign, and then came back to the city.
And I guess, and you benefited from having educated parents that knew education was important. So they probably made that a high priority.
I mean, my dad bought me a computer like a year after we moved here. And again, keep in mind, he was doing odd jobs earning like $5, $10 an hour at the time. So he knew that was so important that, you know, that was one of the first purchases that they made. Commodore 64 used, obviously it was a junker, but at the time it must've cost a couple hundred dollars. So it wasn't a small amount of money compared to their salary.
Yeah.
But it was something that, you know, my dad saw the future in computers and made sure that I got into that real early.
Well, that's really, was really smart of him. I wish there were computers around when I was in high school, even. That would have been nice.
For sure.
Let's get off that for a second and go into your book, Inventing Bitcoin, which you can find at inventingbitcoin.com. You know, I think this is a good book as a starter book, you know, for somebody. I think I used to tell people who were interested in Bitcoin to get Saif Dean's book, you know, the Bitcoin Standard, which I think is a great book.
Great book.
Without a doubt. But I think this is a better starting book, your book. And then, you know, when you get them to read that, then they go, wow, that Bitcoin sounds interesting. What should I read next? Then set them into something a little heavier, like the Bitcoin Standard. That's just my thoughts. I heard it in reverse order, but that was my thoughts. Tell us about your book. What made you write the book?
Yeah, I agree with your assessment. The reason I wrote the book, and it's very short, it's about 100 pages long, and I wrote it because I wanted to have something that was friendly for beginners. And when I started writing it, which was probably in the early 2018, there wasn't a lot in the market. I don't remember if Saif's book was out yet or not, but pretty much everything that was out there was substantial. Like there was Mastering Bitcoin by Andreas Antonopoulos, which was like, you know, 300 or 400 pages, and it was
huge. Very heavy.
Yeah, it's code, and it's like it's meant for developers. It's not meant for your everyday person. And I felt like the resources out there weren't good enough to give people a short understanding of Bitcoin, but that was enough for them to be able to go and explain to somebody else. That was really my goal, was to have something that somebody could read, understand, and feel like they know Bitcoin well enough to defend the ideas of Bitcoin. Like why is it limited in supply? How does mining work? These are the ideas that we cover in the book so that people have a strong understanding. And I started writing the book because I was giving talks at high schools, actually. I was giving a bunch of lectures to high school students in math classes and for career days, because a lot of my friends and my wife is a teacher. So I would just go around to their high schools and basically show Bitcoin to high schoolers. But as part of that, I started, I was taking notes and writing outlines and kind of turned into essays. And that was the beginning of the book. So the book was really meant to be at a high school level. I didn't want anybody to have, you know, a computer science degree or advanced math or nothing like that. It was going to be at a high school level where I could actually give this book to a high schooler and have them understand it and ask questions. And that's what I came up with, is, you know, the process of inventing Bitcoin. How would you go about inventing Bitcoin? Because I think when you walk through the process of inventing something, then you have a really good understanding of all the pieces that comprise it, and you can actually explain it to somebody else.
From your experience of going out talking about Bitcoin and taking your notes and basically your outline, I guess, of what you were talking about, you just decided to put that into a book.
Yeah, and it was almost like a reaction to people's questions, because I think the biggest two biggest questions are, you know, how does Bitcoin work and why does it need to exist? And the why, I cover it by looking at some of Satoshi's quotes and looking at what his motivations were, what was he really trying to achieve? And then once we understand what he is trying to achieve, like he wanted to have, you know, scarcity, he wanted to have anonymity, he wanted to have, you know, these different ideas around, you know, trustlessness, like anybody could join the system, it was permissionless. And then looking at those motivations and then saying, okay, well, how do we actually get that done? How do we implement that in code? And solving those problems one after another. You know, in the book, I talk about it from a very high level. I don't actually get into the computer code, but I do give people enough of an understanding of computer science at a very, like, you know, not even 101 level, just how do computers work in a Bitcoin system and how do they keep each other in check?
Yeah, you don't have to be able to write code to understand what you're talking about in code in this book. Like I said, this book is very well done and I was very impressed. Now, you had Guy Swan narrate this on the audio book version.
Available on Audible.
I think he does a great job. I mean, you know, I think he did a great rebranding job on his site going to Bitcoin Audible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Guy does a great job. And I think the way that he reads is the way that I imagine writing, like kind of, I'm a fast talker, so I would never want to narrate my own book, but the way that he speaks is very clear. And I think it helps sell the ideas in the book, you know, more clearly and let people digest what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with the 4-minute crypto show is I talk really fast, or the 4-minute Bitcoin show, every brand it is. I talk really fast. I had a friend say, you know, I listen to all my podcasts at 1.5 speed, but I have to slow yours down because you're already 1.5 speed.
Yeah, that's what people say about me too. So I try to make a conscious effort to talk slower, but it's hard.
Now, people can find that at your site, but that's also at inventingbitcoin.com. Mm-hmm. But that's also on like Audible.
Audible, Amazon, you can get it in pretty much all the standard channels.
And last year you gave us like, 10 of those that you signed and numbered to give away at BitBlock Boom. And we had drawings in between speakers. And it's amazing how excited people were. My wife said they were really excited when they came down and got their prize. So that was really pretty cool. And then we had some at the table you'd provided that we sold for you. So that was a really productive prize that people seem to have liked. And if anyone's out there, if you're not familiar with BitBlock Boom, that's a Bitcoin conference I put on every year here in Dallas, Texas. And this is our third year coming up for the conference. It's 28th, 29th of August, like I said, in Dallas, Texas. And at BitBlock Boom, we just talk about Bitcoin, not altcoins, not blockchain, just Bitcoin. So if you're interested in Bitcoin, go to bitblockboom.com and check it out. It's starting to turn into a week-long event. I think our first events now are on Thursday night. I would be surprised if someone doesn't add a satellite event for Wednesday at the way things are going. But check out our lineup, see what you think. And if you decide to go, use the code COUSINS, COUSINS, at checkout, and you'll receive 30% off the price of your ticket. So check that out. I hope I get to see you this year in Dallas, everybody. That event really seems to be growing this year.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think because people haven't had anywhere to go.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, this lockdown is not fun.
Yeah, we had Stefan Laveras coming from Australia, but he sent me a message this morning that he's not sure that they're going to unlock, I guess, is he in New Zealand or Australia?
I'm not sure, actually. Yes. Yeah, probably know this.
He said that it looks like they're going to be able to travel there locally by August, but it might be September the 10th before they can leave the country. And that's kind of weird. So he's like keeping us updated so we can figure out if he's still going to be able to come or not. So if not, we may have to get a sub for him and have him in next year. So you also, though, are with Swan Bitcoin and Give Bitcoin. I mean, that's both by the same, they're two different things, but they're by the same entity, I guess.
Yes. Yes. We're one united entity.
Yeah. Tell us about Swan. How's that going?
Swan is doing great. You know, we launched Swan. For those of you who don't know, Swan is a Bitcoin auto stacking service. So we withdraw automatically from your bank account. We buy Bitcoin automatically on a weekly basis. And then we withdraw it back to your Bitcoin wallet also automatically if you choose to set up automatic withdrawals, which is pretty cool. And I'm not sure that anybody else is doing that part. So, you know, lowest fees for that particular service. And, you know, Swan was launched on the eve of the COVID disaster. I think we released it on the week of March 23rd, which is probably the week around the time when the markets were crashing or right after that happened. It was really just a time of despair and doom and gloom. And yet a lot of people were very excited about Swan, and there was so much noise on Twitter, and a lot of people joined up. And, you know, now it's been, 2 months or so, 2.5 months, and we're growing very quickly. We're onboarding new people all the time, and we're getting, we're getting people who aren't your typical, I don't know, your Bitcoin Twitter people. They're not those people. We're getting boomers. We're getting people of all ages, all sex, genders.
You sound surprised that a boomer would.
No, I'm not surprised. I love it. And you know, I think that's really important because I wanted a service that I could send, you know, my parents to. That was really what we wanted to Swan to be. It was a mainstream service for Bitcoin. And it's interesting because the people who, on Bitcoin Twitter, who have a certain set of requirements are very different from your typical person buying Bitcoin for the first time. Because they, for example, they don't understand wallets. They haven't heard of a wallet. What does that mean? How do they do that? So Swan is not just a place to buy Bitcoin. We also couple that with Bitcoin education through our series of blog articles at Swan bitcoin.com/signal, Swan Signal. And then we also have the live show, which we do on Twitter and other channels every week, as well as swansignalpodcast.com, where we basically capture that knowledge and turn it into pods. And we have awesome guests on all the time. We just had Adam Beck and Preston Pish on. It was a lot of fun. So these are the kinds of things that we do because we want to educate people on Bitcoin, not just, you know, they bought a number, which is most people. They went on Coinbase, they bought a number. We don't want that for our next million, 10 million Bitcoiners. We want to have people understand what they bought, why is it important, how does money work, and all of that is stuff that we do through our ongoing education efforts.
Well, when you're saying stacking a platform, in case someone has been under a rock and they don't know what stacking sats are, you're basically saying this site is set up for someone to say, I want to get into Bitcoin and I'm going to buy, just going to make up a number, $100 worth of Bitcoin every payday, every Friday or every other Friday. Mm-hmm. And this service will go ahead and automatically buy at whatever the rate is that day, $100 worth of Bitcoin for them. So slowly, mm-hmm. they're able to save Bitcoin, and they can sit back and they're not like, you know, looking at it all the time, trying to remember, missing it out. Because I think everybody agrees that if you just stack on, use dollar cost averaging, mm-hmm. over the long run, you're going to do better than trying to buy on the lows or buy all at once.
I think, a lot of people who get into Bitcoin then all of a sudden are kind of called into trading. And, you know, if you've never traded stocks or stock options, you know, you probably shouldn't be day trading Bitcoin either. It's not really, it's a very volatile market. It's not really friendly to new traders. And most people aren't traders. They shouldn't be traders, you know. I think as a society, we push people into trading. We have apps like Robinhood and all that that offer, you know, free trading and try to get people hooked on the idea of gambling. But we've really lost the art of saving as a society. We don't remember how to save. Our money obviously is not good for saving because if you save it, it loses value.
Yeah, at least 2%. They're happy if it only loses 2. That's the goal, is 2. So it doesn't meet goal.
Yeah. We believe that Bitcoin is the best money ever invented. It's definitely better than the fiat money that loses value all the time. And so you should be saving some of it all the time. And that's what Swan is about. It's about regular saving of Bitcoin so that you don't have to think about it. It just accumulates for you.
So does that sync up? I know I'm involved, but the things I don't know about, does that sync up to your bank account or to a credit card or to Ether?
It syncs. No credit cards, bank accounts only. And you probably shouldn't be buying Bitcoin on a credit card.
Well, you might buy it to get the miles. You might have the money.
You might, yeah. If you're going to pay it off, sure. But, you know, there's a lot of most credit cards and sort of, you know, in the industry, they have an upcharge for Bitcoin related purchases. And we're just not going to support credit cards for the foreseeable future. But banking, yes. And then we have wires coming in. Pretty soon we're going to have a wire support, so you can just wire in money and it'll clear right away instead of having to wait for the ACH clearance period.
So is that going as expected, better than expected, a little behind because of the COVID than expected?
I think it's going better in the sense that the amounts that people are saving are way more than we ever thought. When we modeled this business, we were conservatively looking at $100 to $150 per customer as their monthly amount. It turns out that the most people, like the most common amounts are $50 or $100 a week, and it could be even higher than that. So, you know, people are stacking more than we thought, which is awesome, especially in a time like this where, you know, finances might be short or people might be losing their paychecks. And we've had a couple of folks put their plans on pause because they lost their job. But the nice thing is that they can always resume when they're ready to go again. And we always try to lower that limit. So, you know, if it's $5 a month is all you can afford, then that's what you can do. It's fine.
So when you buy that, does it stay in the Swan wallet, or when you buy it, does it automatically transfer using your key to your wallet?
So we have both options. What we find is a lot of people who are new to Bitcoin are not comfortable setting up wallets yet. So we obviously when you buy it, it's bought on our side, it's bought through our custodial partner. And we partner with a licensed and regulated Nevada chartered trust company called Prime Trust. And so all of that happens on their side and is held in offline cold storage. So that if people are new to Bitcoin, then essentially their coins are safe. But we're trying to, of course, you know, with as Bitcoiners, we want to promote not your keys, not your coins. We want to promote for people to take custody of their own assets. So what we do to encourage that is we create an auto withdrawal plan for people. So once they are ready to set up a wallet And we just put together a great article about all the wallets that are out there and recommend different kinds of wallets for different different amounts that you might be storing. And once you have set up a wallet, you can just create an auto withdrawal plan. And so every time you buy Bitcoin, it'll withdraw. You can even set it up so that it has thresholds so that you don't withdraw every $5, you withdraw every $100 or every $500 or every certain amount of Bitcoin.
Batches it up.
Yeah, we want to encourage batching because this is something, again, a lot of newbies don't know, but if your coins are all split up into small pieces, then later when you want to use them, it'll cost you more to spend them because of the way that transaction fees work based on the amount of data. A lot of people new to Bitcoin don't understand transaction fees. Now, Swan actually has free withdrawals. We don't charge you for withdrawals at all. So it's to your benefit to use that for batching. So go ahead and batch up a bunch of them and withdraw once, and then you have this nice chunk, and then you can spend it later.
I didn't know that it had free withdrawals.
Free withdrawals. Nice. We haven't been super vocal about it. We're trying to get it more in more places. We're just not, we're not at a point where the site design is where we want it in terms of advertising all the different bits and pieces. And that's because it's challenging to balance all the exciting features that are good for people who understand what they're looking for versus, making a really simple experience for newbies. And so we've erred on the side of having it just kind of minimal. And then over time, we'll be adding more stuff in.
I was going to Give Bitcoin real quick. Has that gotten kind of put on the back burner for Swan?
Give Bitcoin was the first product before Swan came out. And Give Bitcoin was essentially envisioned as an on-ramp to Bitcoiners. And it also had a purchasing feature to it. But we never did a good job marketing it. And I think that when we realized what the landscape was, that people were so much more excited about automatic purchases of Bitcoin, we just decided to pursue that fully. And
Give Bitcoin, that's why I was wondering if it got kind of like set on the sideburner.
Yeah, it works. It exists. It's, it's attracting users every day kind of by itself, but we definitely don't spend a lot of time marketing it. And the reason for that is we eventually envision Swan becoming the umbrella brand for all of this. So you'll have a Swan app, it'll do the Swan auto stacking, but it will also allow you to give gifts to people.
So it kind of would be incorporated into the Swan.
Yeah, we'll fold it back in. Yeah. But since we're a small company, it kind of benefits us to put all of our efforts on one thing and really grow that thing. And then we can fold more features in.
But Give Bitcoin is a good way to give Bitcoin.
It is.
I mean, if you want to give someone a Christmas present of Give Bitcoin, it's a pretty good way to do it.
Yeah. And Give Bitcoin is also designed for, your average kind of newbie to Bitcoin, where, a kid asks their uncle for a Bitcoin present. Well, then the uncle doesn't have to understand Bitcoin in order to give him the present. He can just go on to Give Bitcoin, plug in their bank account, and we do all the conversion automatically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good for that. Now, what is Bitcoiner VC?
Bitcoiner Ventures. Yeah, so Bitcoiner Ventures is a partnership between myself and Corey and Stefan Lavera and Louis Liu. And it's a way for us to raise money for Bitcoin-friendly companies. Companies that are good for Bitcoin. That's our litmus test, is it good for Bitcoin? It's an angelist syndicate, and we don't take any fees. There are angelist fees, but we, as the partners, we don't actually take any carry or what you might find in a regular hedge fund where people take fees on the investments. So it's kind of like a pro bono, good faith thing that we're doing in order to invest in Bitcoin companies. And we commit our own money just alongside everybody else. It's not we're never going to ask somebody for money where we don't commit. We just did our first deal, which was for Unchained Capital. And that's live. So
what was that deal?
That's closed. Well, we raised about $100,000 for Unchained Capital.
Mm. Yeah. Now they're our platinum sponsor at BitBlock Boom this year. Kind of excited to have them involved.
Awesome. Yeah, Unchained is great, fantastic team, and we were very excited to help them because we really believe in their mission and also just the way that they execute. They're very, very smart in how they treat funds on chain, and obviously they're vaulting products are very excellent. So we believe that these products have to exist for Bitcoin to succeed. And so that's the kind of companies we want to fund.
So that was your first venture was Unchained Capital. That's cool. I found that by accident. I didn't even know that Bitcoin or VC existed. I found it by accident.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to join up, it's you can just join the Angelist Syndicate. It's called Bitcoin or Ventures. You can find it on Angelist. And there's no commitment or any obligation to invest. You'll just be able to essentially see all the deals that are coming across. And then if you're interested in any particular deal, you can sign up to do that.
But any deals that you guys do promote, you're basically putting your own money in?
Yes. Yeah, we won't promote anything that we're not funding ourselves.
So how many deals do you have in the works right now, or do you have any in the works?
We have a few, but we are not allowed to talk about any deals. So we can't promote anything if you're not a partner in the syndicate. So I can't talk about it publicly.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah, I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't know the scoop. So, okay. So if you're interested, if you want to find out, go join Bitcoin or VC.
Yeah. And again, there's no obligation. Just go ahead.
Is there any kind of test you got to pass or anything? I mean, is anyone can?
Well, you have to pass an accreditation test on AngelList. They take care of all that for us. So we're just, we're basically just helping find deals.
Yeah, I was looking at that last week. The what is that, Angel Investor?
AngelList.
AngelList.
So it's at angel.co, if you guys don't know.
Yeah, I was surprised. I found I was a member of that or something. I didn't even know. I guess I don't know when I signed up or when that happened.
They have like a network of stuff. They have, you can create your own profile if you're even just like a developer or entrepreneur. So they did a lot of stuff to connect essentially the whole venture capital and startup community. So a lot of people have AngelList accounts that they don't remember because they signed up as a developer or something a long time ago.
Yeah, Stephen Cole told me about it. I had him on last week. And so I was looking at the site last week because he was telling me about it. Okay, so now I got to scoop on the VC. Hey, what did you think of the halvening? Was that, were you kind of let down, or is that what you were expecting? Or
I mean, I expected Bitcoin not to change its monetary policy, and it held up phenomenally well. As far as price, I don't really look at day-to-day price movements. I don't think it's that important. I'm into Bitcoin for a very long time, and I think of it as money for my children and grandchildren. So this halving, whatever, it's the third out of many. Yeah. There will be many more to come. There will be two more this decade.
I was looking for a little bit more excitement, a little more... maybe some online parties or something,
There was some, there were some Zoom chats. I think because of the COVID, everybody's like, you're going to party in a Zoom chat or something. But
I was looking, I think maybe a drunken chat where everybody had a bottle of wine or a bottle of whiskey.
I think it's awesome that the whole mining death spiral narrative is getting destroyed right now because there's all these, people saying that mining was going to be over. It's not going to be profitable. And I think people don't understand how mining works and keep writing articles about it, which is sad. They need to research.
Do you think they said that the same thing about miners during the second halving?
I think they did. I mean, as far as I know, there were forum posts going back to like 2011 where they were talking about the mining death spiral, going into the first halving. So this has been going on. This narrative has been going on for a long time. And I think it fundamentally misunderstands how mining works. I mean, it's an incentive aligned system. And if people are unprofitable, yeah, they're going to unplug. But that makes other people more profitable, right? And so all it does is it shifts the energy usage to places where there's, more efficient, cheaper energy. So yeah, some guys, in their garages are no longer profitable. Mining adjusts itself. It's the beauty of the whole thing is that it's a self-regulating system.
The difficulty adjustment happens every 2 weeks, according to what's going before it. So
exactly.
Hey, you listen to podcasts.
I used to listen to a lot, now less because I don't drive anymore, which is unfortunate.
I think that's affected the podcast industry as a whole.
I bet it did.
That no one's in their cars or buses or trains, and that's when people listen to most podcasts. What are a couple of your favorite podcasts?
I like Stefan Lavera's pod, Marty Bent, Tales from the Crypt. I listen to the What's Happening podcast with Cassie. I listened to a few episodes of that and was pretty impressed. But then I stopped because I stopped driving.
Right. Yeah, that's killed a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, so sad. I'm trying to figure out a routine where I will actually find time to listen to pods.
Yeah.
But I also, the other one I've been actually listening to more, I almost stopped listening to Bitcoin podcasts in favor of listening to Macro Voices, which I love so much now. It's a podcast just about macroeconomics and various trends, and they've been really interesting because they talked about the virus and how that was going to impact things and deflation, inflation. Like, this stuff has become more interesting to me almost than Bitcoin. I mean, obviously Bitcoin is the number one thing in my life and I talk about it all the time, but you have to have interests outside of Bitcoin. And I think macro is kind of a very nice adjacent thing to expand your mind on when you're looking at Bitcoin.
I think what's hurt me with podcasts is all of a sudden I started listening to audiobooks.
Oh yeah.
I was listening to one book recently, which was like 20 hours, and I drive 5 minutes to work. So it took me a long time. A lot of episodes of podcasts came out. But I think listening to audiobooks has hurt my podcast listening habits. Hey, before we get out of here, is there anything you want to tell people that we might not have gone over that you wanted to make sure and let people know, or that you were trying to promote, or want to make sure you don't come on here and we miss them?
Sure. We have a new concept on Swan, which is you can have your own vanity landing page with a welcome bar. It's got your face on it and a quote.
No.
And this is for people who want to drive more traffic to the site. So you can go to swanbitcoin.com/enlist to enlist in the Swan Force and become a promoter of Bitcoin. Really, it's all about promoting Bitcoin and help, and using Swan to onboard new Bitcoiners. And we're going to be providing a library of memes you can use on Twitter and other places to promote Bitcoin and get more people on board. So if you're interested in that kind of thing and you have an audience, go to swanbitcoin.com/enlist and become one of our, one of our promoters, and, just get more Bitcoiners on board.
Yeah, I need to do that. I guess I send people. Yeah. I just send people. I don't know where I don't even know if I'm sending.
I thought
it to...
we gave you one. Let's see here. Don't we have /Gary for you?
I don't know. Do we?
We do have /Gary for you.
Oh, I didn't even know. There you go.
Yes.
I didn't
go to swanbitcoin.com/Gary.
Okay. Yeah. So if you're listening to this, Swan Bitcoin. I didn't even know.
Okay, we're gonna. So yours doesn't have a face on it, but we're gonna fix that up right after this interview. I think we can do that
okay.
If you're interested.
Well, I'll start using that. I usually use a short link because I can't ever remember, what affiliate links are and stuff. But I can remember that one. I can remember.
So whenever you send somebody there and you have a profile, they're gonna get a bonus. They're gonna get a sign up bonus, and then you get as a promoter, if you're part of the Swan Force, you're gonna get a percentage of their future purchases, as well as an initial referral fee.
Oh, cool.
So definitely check that out. swanbitcoin.com/enlist. We need to get swanforce.com, but
I'm going to like look at Gary because I didn't even know it was there.
You go to /Gary. We're going to talk about getting you a bar after the show.
Sounds good. Well, I appreciate you coming on time. Where can people follow you at? Where's the best place for them to follow you?
Find me on Twitter, SKWP, pronounced scoop, SKWP.
What does that mean? What is that? Why do you have SKWP?
It's a name I chose when I was 14 years old.
Okay.
And it's stuck since then. And it's actually a character from an Isaac Asimov book, who was an alien scribe, spoke, hundreds of languages, which, I'm a linguistics nerd, so.
How's that pronounced then, linguistic nerd?
It's pronounced scoop.
Oh, that's pronounced scoop. Okay.
SKWP. Yeah. And that's the pronunciation they gave in the book. So I don't know.
Okay. Well, I didn't know. I figured there was a way to read it if it was in the book. I mean, so there was something if someone's name in the book.
Yeah. Scoop.
Okay. Scoop. So is that your nickname? Is that what everybody called you when you were a kid?
No, just online. Oh. Just my online handle. Okay. Back from IRC days and BBSs and whatnot.
Okay. It's funny. Mine was P. Dilly. After the pickle, back in the days, and I hated pickles. People always go, awesome. You must really love pickles. I hate pickles. I don't know why.
That's pretty funny.
So, I'm going to let you go. I appreciate you coming on the show, and just to let you know, you're officially now a crypto cousin. So, welcome to the badge. I hope you've enjoyed today's show, and I want to give a big thank you to all my cousins out there for listening and subscribing. If you haven't subscribed yet, just go to CryptoCousins.com, and you'll see the links for all the places you can subscribe. You may want to take a second and leave a great review or a 4-star rating even while you're at it. I also recommend you go to CryptoPodcaster.com and see all my other podcasts and websites for the world of Bitcoin. There's a lot of them to look at.
Thanks for listening to the Crypto Cousins podcast. Please share the show with your friends. They can subscribe by going to CryptoCousins.com/subscribe. And if you want to know more about Gary, just go to GaryLeland.com. Make sure and join Gary and all the Crypto Cousins every week for a new episode of the Crypto Cousins podcast. The Crypto Cousins podcast and the information included in the podcast are not intended as investment advice. Investing in any cryptocurrency is risky, and you should never invest more than you can afford to lose. Always seek professional advice before investing in any cryptocurrency. Please understand, you are using any and all information from the Crypto Cousins at your own risk.